Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A tense calm in eastern Ukraine after a ceasefire is announced, and Ebola continues to spread across West Africa. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. A ceasefire between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian separatists appears to be holding in eastern Ukraine, raising prospects for a halt to 5 months of saber-rattling and violence. The truce was approved Friday by envoys from the Kiev government, the separatist movement, Moscow, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko.
In this protocol, there is 12 practical steps for establishing peace and stability in part of the Donetsk and Lugansk region of Ukraine. With the respect of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence of Ukraine. As we said, this is the key issue now, the basis for the finding out a peaceful solution of the crisis on the east of Ukraine.
In spite of the agreement, each side is accusing the other of violating the ceasefire. Russia, meantime, vowing to react if the European imposes more economic sanctions, as it has promised to do on Monday. The World Health Organization says it will fast-track approval of experimental treatments of the Ebola virus as the death toll in West Africa jumps to more than 2,000. The race for a cure comes as the WHO says the Ebola outbreak is escalating in Guinea, Liberia, and in Sierra Leone, where the government has ordered a lockdown later this month.
Unfortunately, there is no evidences yet that we control the outbreak. I think it's becoming even worse.
The WHO said Friday, survivors' blood can be used immediately to treat those who are infected with the virus. This is VOA News. U.S. officials have confirmed that an airstrike in Somalia killed Ahmed Abdi Ghadani, the leader of the militant group Al-Shabaab. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the confirmation is a major blow to the terror group.
We think this will degrade their morale and hopefully it will also cause some internal strife as they try to determine who their next leader will be. And of course, whoever that next leader is will immediately need to worry about his safety as well.
Warren says the strike killed several other al-Shabaab personnel in addition to the group's leader and was conducted in a very remote area of Somalia, with the military confident that no civilians were killed. President Barack Obama said Friday the U.S. has worked consistently to degrade al-Shabaab's operations.
We have been very systematic and methodical in going after these kinds of organizations that may threaten U.S. personnel and the homeland.
Witnesses report a U.S. drone launched missiles at a meeting of al-Shabaab leaders in southern Somalia. Syrian airstrikes targeting the Islamic State stronghold of Raqqa have killed at least 16 civilians. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the civilians died in the bombing of a bakery run by Islamic State militants. Other strikes hit a training camp and a government finance building, both used by the extremist group. Islamic State fighters are among the dead. The northeastern city of Raqqa is the group's main foothold in Syria. U.S. job growth slowed sharply last month, with employers adding only 142,000 jobs in August, and that is well below analyst expectations. Millar Sega reports.
For some job seekers, August was not a good month. Hiring fell to the slowest pace in 8 months, and the previous estimate for June was revised lower by 28,000 jobs. But if financial markets were worried, it didn't show. After the initial disappointment, stocks returned to positive territory. A new study by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants shows 20% of businesses surveyed expect to hire more staff. Seasonal aberration or not, U.S. unemployment fell 0.1% to 6.1%, likely because fewer people were looking for work. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
The search for a small private plane that left the U.S., crossed through Cuban airspace, and then crashed off the coast of Jamaica continues today. The aircraft made a ghostly 2,700-kilometer journey from upstate New York down the Atlantic coast and beyond Friday before crashing. The pilot had been in touch with air traffic controllers at least twice. He wanted to ask for a descent in altitude. He stopped responding, and the U.S. military dispatched jets to investigate, which saw the windows fog up, suggesting that the pilot was, in fact, already dead. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
We are going to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL the same way that we have gone after Al-Qaeda, the same way that we have gone after the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia. You know, we have been very systematic and methodical in going after these kinds of organizations that may threaten U.S. personnel and the homeland.
The United States confirms the death of an Al-Shabaab leader.
I just think the response has been very delayed, too little and too late. They were starting to ramp up now, but only once it's gotten out of control.
Could the West African Ebola outbreak have been avoided? We ask an expert.
As far as the government, unfortunately, it seems like the justice system has effectively stopped functioning because of the overwhelming presence of these armed groups.
And in Libya, civilians at risk as armed groups continue fighting. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. The Pentagon has confirmed that U.S. airstrikes in Somalia earlier this week killed the leader of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
It's taken 4 days, but the Pentagon is now certain that Al-Shabaab leader Ahmed Ghadane is dead. Ghadane was killed after U.S. forces rained Hellfire missiles and laser-guided munitions onto an Al-Shabaab encampment and a vehicle. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the confirmation is a major blow to the terror group.
We think this will degrade their morale and hopefully it will also cause some internal strife as they try to determine who their next leader will be. And of course, whoever that next leader is will immediately need to worry about his safety as well.
Warren says the strike killed several other Al-Shabaab personnel in addition to Ghadane. He says it was conducted in a very remote area of Somalia and that the military was confident that no civilians were killed. U.S. President Barack Obama said the death of the Al-Shabaab leader was an example of America's deliberate approach to dismantling Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. Speaking at the NATO summit in Wales, Mr. Obama warned Islamic State militants in the Middle East that they will face a similar fate.
We are going to degrade and ultimately defeat ISIL the same way that we have gone after Al-Qaeda, the same way that we have gone after the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia. You know, we have been very systematic and methodical in going after these kinds of organizations that may threaten U.S. personnel and the homeland.
At the Pentagon, Colonel Warren was quick to point out the strong relationship the United States has with the Somali government.
And they've helped us quite a bit. And we have to make that clear that it is the collaborative relationship with host nations that really allows us to bring the fight to the enemy.
The Pentagon, however, would not discuss details of how much, if at all, it coordinated with the Somali government ahead of Monday's strike. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Meanwhile, in West Africa, the Ebola caseload continues to grow in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, even as more people cooperate with health officials. Health workers are struggling to identify and isolate the sick before they can infect others. VOA's Anne Luke files this report from Monrovia, where health volunteers are now going door to door looking for sick people.
A brief celebration amid all the sickness and death. 12 Ebola survivors are released from the government-run Elwa 2 treatment unit. Deputy Health Minister Tolbert Nyansua joins in on their dancing. He later tells VOA this was an example of the progress they are making every day in Monrovia, but admits it's slow going.
The fact is that transmission is still going on. I am not saying that transmission has been broken, no. I cannot deceive the world.
Liberia must outflank the virus. Health volunteers have started doing rounds in West Point, a low-income area placed under quarantine for nearly 2 weeks in August. The volunteers go door to door through the cramped, musty alleyways, looking for sick people. They don't use the word Ebola.
Okay, we are here on Health Matters, We want to know as to whether you have any sick person, somebody suffering from malaria, fever, typhoid, pressure.
Many people shake their heads. They ask again, Anyone have a cold? Are any children sick? People shake their heads.
No one is sick. They're not sick.
It's the height of the malaria and typhoid season, and those people need care. But Ebola has similar symptoms. Suspected cases must be found and taken to isolation. The volunteer team hears there may be someone sick near the mosque, so they head that way. Is anyone sick here, they ask. Has anyone died recently? Two houses away, they find a sick girl. She's had fever and vomiting. She comes out rubbing her eyes. A neighbor puts her hand on the girl's shoulder and tries to answer their questions. The volunteers add the girl to their list. They say a response team will follow up, but no one seems to know who will come or when. Back at the area's health center, the waiting room is nearly empty. Staff say people are scared to come due to fears they may get contaminated or be taken to isolation. Contact tracers deliver their midday reports.
I have 10 contact points on the survey. I met all of them.
They have just visited about 150 people in relation to 30 suspected Ebola victims. Supervisor Marie Hiding says these daily follow-ups are chipping away at resistance to government efforts.
Because when you see somebody going to your house every day, oh, how are you coming on? Are you sick today? No. You know, and they will be happy to see us because they will know that we are care for them and we are concerned.
The government lifted the quarantine on West Point on August 30th. Authorities barricaded the area after a mob attacked a holding center for suspected Ebola patients in West Point on August 17th. The quarantine led to panic and was criticized as counterproductive. Government spokesman Lewis Brown defends it.
There was a level of denial that needed, in our mind, shock therapy. People needed to be sort of awakened to the fact that, look, this is deadly and it is serious. And this is no hanky-panky business.
But as resistance fades, another challenge is amplified. Where can sick people go? Ebola treatment units in the capital are full. However, Doctors Without Borders is expanding its unit at Elwa 3 to add 280 beds. Other agencies are building 5 more units to open later this month. In the meantime, Ebola stays a few steps ahead of the response. Ann Look, VOA News, Monrovia.
Meanwhile, a U.S. expert on global health says the West African Ebola outbreak could have been avoided. Professor Lawrence Gostin is director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University and director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on Public Health Law in Human Rights. His comments appear in the medical journal The Lancet. Gostin spoke to VOA's Jody Kapwa about his reaction to the West African Ebola outbreak, which has killed nearly 2,000 people.
I rarely have this reaction, but I'm actually visibly upset about it because I think this is such a tragedy unfolding in West Africa, and it really never had to happen. We've really dropped the ball as an international community. We've been distracted by ISIS and other foreign crises, and yet there's a crisis just unfolding in front of our eyes in some of the poorest countries in the world, and I just think that the response has been very delayed, too little, and too late. That we're starting to ramp up now, but only once it's gotten out of control.
Why do you think this could have been avoided?
Well, I think it could easily be avoided. I mean, the thing about Ebola is that it's preventable, unlike, say, influenza, which is airborne and travels rapidly. So if you remember the H1N1 pandemic, it just spread quickly. This is the first Ebola outbreak that we've not been able to contain early. And if we had reasonable health systems on the ground, healthcare workers who were trained, who had safety and personal protection equipment, where there were sterile and safe isolation units and public health officers to do contact tracing, we could have kept this cabined and not let it run amok. And it has run amok. In fact, the World Health Organization waited 5 months to put out its Ebola response roadmap, after the first international spread of Ebola. And that's a long time to let an epidemic fan out of control.
Just about any humanitarian agency we speak with that's involved in the Ebola outbreak in West Africa says two things. They need more protective suits, but they definitely need a lot more healthcare personnel.
They do. I mean, these are countries that began the Ebola crisis with severe shortages of health personnel. In fact, 1/10, and in some cases 1/20, the amount of doctors, nurses, midwives that we would need for the bare minimum of health care. And now we've lost probably over 130 doctors and nurses from the region, and there are critical human resource shortages, and there are shortages of people, of training, of equipment, of the ability to protect themselves against infection. It's just very fragile and shaky, and I think it's outrageous that the international community has not built the health systems that are needed. And if we just helicopter in to the most affected countries the way we did with Haiti, and then do a humanitarian relief, and then leave them with the same fragile health system, it will happen again, and it will be an inexcusable tragedy. That's why in the journal The Lancet, I've called for an international health systems fund. That is a contingency fund for surge capacity and then for longer-term building of health system capacity. I think it's critical.
You're right that taking that action could spark what you call a badly needed global course correction that would favor strong health infrastructure.
Yes, I do write that, and I believe it very strongly. I mean, I think international development assistance has been very much focused on particular diseases and particular battles, you know, enormous resources going into important things like polio eradication. And, of course, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis are great killers in the African continent. But in the end, the only way we're going to stop Ebola, treat AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis, and also prevent and treat cancer, heart disease, diabetes, massive injuries that occur in that region, is to help countries help themselves through good doctors, good nurses, good hospitals, good clinics, good prevention services. That will bring trust in government, and it will also bring health for the population. And health is a universal yearning. And the fact that we have allowed these fragile systems to go on for so long is, I think, unconscionable. And perhaps this is the wake-up call we needed.
That was Professor Lawrence Gustin, director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapwa. Meanwhile, up in North Africa, all armed groups fighting in Libya need to ensure that the protection of civilians is a priority, as according to the UN Human Rights Office. Ravina Shamdasani, a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office, says attacks are taking place in densely populated residential areas while necessary precautions are not in place to protect civilians. A new UN report released on Thursday warns that serious violations of international human rights and humanitarian law are taking place in the Libyan cities of Tripoli and Benghazi. UN Radio's Patrick Maigua asked Ms. Shamdasani about the situation in these two cities.
The situation in particular in Tripoli and Benghazi is seriously deteriorating. We have seen a lot of fighting going on between armed groups in these two cities in particular. And unfortunately, many of the weapons that are being used by these armed groups are unreliable, inaccurate, old and poorly maintained, and the fighters often appear to disregard the likely impact on civilians. What has ended up happening is we're seeing civilian casualties in densely populated areas, and there's a high likelihood that most of these attacks carried out are indiscriminate.
You've talked about armed groups. Is the government also responding to these attacks?
Well, in fact, it's a number of different armed groups. There are the Misrata-affiliated armed groups, the Zintan-affiliated armed groups. There are a number of them which have been involved in both Benghazi and in Tripoli. As far as the government, unfortunately, it seems like the justice system has effectively stopped functioning because of the overwhelming presence of these armed groups.
And has there been civilian casualties, or what is the situation of civilians?
Yes, unfortunately, there have been civilian casualties, including of women and children. As I mentioned, some of these attacks are taking place in densely populated residential areas. And from the reports that we are receiving, it doesn't seem like the necessary precautions are being taken to protect civilians. This is why one of our main calls at the moment is that all sides have to ensure that the protection of civilians is a priority. International humanitarian law requires all parties to comply with the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precautions in attack. And this is particularly important in densely populated areas.
There has also been a number of abductions. What details do you have on this?
Yes, there have been quite a few abductions, including of civilians. And in some cases, it is unclear where these people have ended up. And what we are stressing is that if the parties to the conflict do not acknowledge the whereabouts of these people, these incidents could amount to enforced disappearances.
Who will bear the responsibility, or who will undertake any investigations if the justice system is not functioning?
This is a key concern of ours. I mean, the justice system, as in the courts in Tripoli, have effectively stopped functioning. But, however, it is most important right now to get these systems functioning, first of all, and then for these armed groups to hand over any members amongst them who are believed to have breached international human rights law and international humanitarian law, for them to hand over all members who are suspected to have breached these laws and all members who are suspected of having committed abuses, to hand them over to the justice system.
Libya is home to migrants, especially from sub-Saharan Africa. Are they affected by this fighting?
Yes, indeed. Migrants have always been vulnerable in Libya, but they are particularly exposed in the current context. And we've had reports of migrants waiting for up to 17 days on the border between Libya and Tunisia for them before they were able to cross over.
And are people willing to come forward and probably give any evidence of any human rights violations that are there?
It's a very difficult situation. UNSMIL, which is the UN support mission in Libya, international staff were evacuated in mid-July due to the fighting in Tripoli. But they are actively monitoring the situation from other locations. And they've been able to obtain information from human rights defenders, from medical personnel, from members of the judiciary, and from families of victims, among others. However, this is a problem that there are people who are very afraid of speaking out because of the deepening political polarization, because there's this climate of fear where people are worried that if they speak out about, for example, relatives who have been abducted, that may put their relatives at risk.
Ravina Ramshadasani, a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office, she spoke with UN Radio's Patrick Maigua. Now, Clifton Tolbert is an African-American businessman and speaker. He's also the author of 13 books, looking back at the days of segregation in the Mississippi Delta. Tolbert has used the values he grew up with as principles for successful and ethical business management. In part one of a two-part interview, reporter William Ego spoke to Mr. Tolbert about his life and philosophy. He says while segregation was an assault on African-American equality and freedom, it did encourage self-reliance and strong values among black communities.
As I look back and recall my life growing up during the era of legal segregation, there's no doubt in my mind that opportunities were few and barriers were everywhere. But there was also something else there, what I call that survival instinct, that tremendous sense of community, where the elders within our community had vision for their children and the next generation. It was as if unselfishness was unleashed in such a way that they gave us reason to believe that we could face tomorrow, and tomorrow would be better as a result of that.
Some historians have said that segregation, of course, limited black businessmen and entrepreneurs. The good thing was that it forced the community to rely on its own resources, and in fact, black businesses flourished, as did schools and education, whereas with the end of segregation, it was open to more competition, and some of that broke down. Some businesses went under, faced with larger competition, white businesses, for example.
Well, you know, it's interesting when I think about the harshness of legal segregation. I see that as a surrounding barriers. And so it would seem that that pressure would have been so strong and so overwhelming that one would not have had the opportunity to think for a better life for themselves. But what I find to be interesting, that even in the 200 or so years of slavery, once slavery was over, there was this incredible move toward self-sufficiency. There was this incredible move toward education. Even though color was a divisive boundary that still existed, but within that divisive boundary, the mindset of African Americans were, we are going to make this thing happen for us. But of course, when integration came, the idea that you could stretch your wings further and make even greater contributions, that did begin to happen. But in so doing, I think that it also gave way to the breakdown in the solidarity that many of us had experienced during those years of legal segregation.
There's always been in the African-American community those who favored education and individual progress versus class action and legal remedies. This was particularly 100 years ago, the turn of the century, around the 1900s. Did you witness that in your childhood, and what are your views today?
You know, I think life is incredibly complex, and I'm not sure there are either ors in that very dynamic sphere that we're speaking of how to go about bringing about the equality of effort, the equality of education, how to go about giving everybody a seat at the tables, but at the same time allowing them to maximize their potential and be very, let's say, really excited about their potential being maximized. You know, I think that as in every area of our lives, there will be certain processes that work best during a certain period of time, and then there are other processes that you build upon. I mean, there was a time in America that had we not marched, I doubted we would be having this conversation today. But does that mean we still march today, or does that mean that we look at what marching has accomplished, and now we look for what is the next level that we need to embrace as Americans, all of us together, moving us toward that spot of equity that our documents allude to?
Today, the Supreme Court is modifying some of the measures or protections put in place to protect voting rights, particularly in those states that had a history of voter discrimination. Supporters say it's part of an effort to make the law, quote-unquote, colorblind. What's your reaction to that?
You know, I have multiple reactions, because the one thing that I don't know as these laws are being enacted, I don't have the privilege of being able to sit at the table with a couple of people who may be powerful and influential. I'm not sure what's driving them. I hear what they say, but I'm not quite sure at this point in my life of the motivation that drives them. You know, I'm not sure that we've had these things in place long enough to really reach, for them to have reached their full potential. I would rather err on the side of having them longer than not having them long enough.
That was author, speaker, and entrepreneur Clifton Talbot. He was speaking with our VOA reporter William Eagle.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share the ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
You're listening to Netland Africa coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America, and coming up in the second half of the program, Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent, and then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. But just before our Saturday Music Spot, let's look at African athletics. The world's fastest marathon runner, Geoffrey Mutai, will test his speed Saturday in a 10-kilometer race in Prague, the Czech Republic. The 32-year-old Mutai, who will defend his New York City Marathon title in early November, is expected to be challenged for the title in Prague by a few of his Kenyan countrymen. The energetic Andy Edwards has this preview for VOA from the Czech capital.
His best for 10K on the road is an impressive 27 minutes 19 seconds, achieved 3 years ago and 9 weeks after Geoffrey Mutai became the fastest marathon runner in history. That was in Boston in 2011, but the American course does not meet the requirements for official world records. Since then, he's broken the course record in the New York Marathon, a performance he rates even higher than his triumph in Boston. He arrived in Prague to test his form before the title defense in New York in early November. Now, among his rivals is Geoffrey Rono, the fellow Kenyan who surprised the world marathon record holder Wilson Kipsang to win the Olomouc half marathon 9 weeks ago here in the Czech Republic. Both men, the established star Mutai and the newcomer Rono, have a deep competitive streak which has taken them to elite level, yet are relaxed enough to share morning training runs and breakfast together. Geoffrey Mutai sees no contradiction in this.
Actually, a sport thing is a different, not like a boxing. Of course, even we don't have rivals. It's depending on your shape. And again, if you have something pain with the other colleague and you are not strong in the road, they will leave you. But the determination is only the shape which you have. It's not only to be rivals. But for me, I'm taking all my colleagues like are my friends. So the shape is depending.
Since his triumph on debut in the half marathon, having entered as a pacemaker, Geoffrey Rono has improved his best at that distance to a truly world-class 59 minutes 45, with victory in Austria 2 weeks ago. He fears no rival, even Geoffrey Mutai.
I have no pressure. I am fine. I've been training well since then. And in two weeks ago, I was in another race in Austria. So I know my form is good. And if it all goes well, I'm expecting to stage another surprise.
The course record stands at 27 minutes 34, set 3 years ago by another Kenyan, Philemon Limo. Daniel Chibi, who won last year and finished just 1 second outside, also runs this time. But all Geoffrey Mutai's concentration is on performing to his best on Saturday evening.
Actually, when I'm coming to the 10K and a marathon, for me, I only focus for the race which I've already prepared myself. There is no race which I'm taking that it's some small race. For me, I usually taking like it's a big race so that it can help me in mentality to achieve in that race.
There's a strong Kenyan entry in the women's race, headed by Hella Kiprop, who is the fastest of five runners to have broken 32 minutes for the distance. Kiprop is preparing for an autumn marathon, the venue still to be decided, and looks to the 10K as a form guide.
My preparation is very okay. I come here to see my preparation about the marathon. So I want to see my speed. I know I will have a big competition, but I want to try my best.
The race itself is distinctive with an unusual start time of 7:30 in the evening, unlike so many morning or midday races. It's part of the Run Czech series of road races, which is growing in popularity, not least with the number of elite East African runners who are basing themselves in Prague. For the sunny side of sports, this is Andy Edwards in Prague.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game on. This is for the world. Just come and play with me. This is for the globe. Just come.
That's right. Now, time for our Saturday music spot. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, beginning with this tune by from Uganda.
Step nga tambuka, hey, kamese tambula, omanye ngeri je tweyisa, kaligwera mweyo, muga katonda, poluke tele tubala, mulavu nge tungo ya goya, ah, yeah, 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 ay, sikuli mande mukatu mulavu mukwane ngo ya goya, sikuli mbengo ya goya, Katwengo ya goya Echuma chaka soli mbache tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Dimu katwengo ya goya Nakulandi wa malonyo Ono ya mponye chalo Umanye vinye watavi woma Gabia mpulunguse Nebo vikube noga Muli oulira tebitambula Sawa kwa tano labo muka Wabula mudido Liato lia injini Teri manyama yengo Woma nyivo mkwata Evi omu kwa noto vipapira Masigansuwa Evi omu kwa no mpola mpola Mama mpola mpola tupigite Sikuli mande mkatumula Umu kwa nengo ya goya Sikuli mengo ya goya Katwengo ya goya Echuma chaka soli mbache tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Limu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Oh, nasalamo Ya mkwata ni mkwata lafu Ya mfunza funza msonda Tuka ya chipoli Eno lafu Etamanya tioli nechitiwa Mfuga vya chila lulavu Zentide walai yeah. Lafu Enzime amasu ngomze Sikuli mbande mukatumu lafu Mukwane ngo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Mbe mukatumu Chuma chaka soli mbache tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbande mkatumu lavu Mkwanengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya Chuma chaka soli mbache tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Ndimu katwengo ya goya
She's beautiful. Beautiful.
Baby.
Julia, no one can walk. But you want to step on Kapanka.
amazima kati yonkudeka banka toyagala kulinnya ntaksi mupaka niwajuka belani wamanka aspino yomukwano webityo wenyuwan sometimes okomawo nga holisan eyali yakwagala yakowa yabuka tasaliwo yeyagenda lavetufoso byangane wenenya sesoringa mabibi amenya kamilian melodi diswana sibaba parodi kom kom. Now she say that she want me again. She won't come to me harder with me again. But we got no time for me say, I say, don't bring me back to your feelings, got a loba. Did you show how the games you play? Who in this room shall keep your missy taggy? I say, Papi, you were not the one for me. So now you know that we cannot be together.
I got an collecting, you say.
Salva Kirisu Diriwali.
Ah, ah,
show me the way.
Yes, that's the South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka. Before that, you had Wale Wale and Nkolechi by Uganda's Jose Chameleone, and we began by Engoya Goya by Angela Kalule. And that was our Saturday Music Spot. I hope you enjoyed all that music. Now, the Saturday Commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Nyang.
Welcome, Africa. It's always a pleasure to share my reflections about American policies towards Africa, and I also pay a great deal of attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. As I look at what our telecasters are putting out in the media and what our scholars and journalists are writing about America's relations with Africa, this analysis is always a two-way analysis. What is coming out of Africa with respect to America, and what is coming out of America and the impact on the African scene. So today, as I look at the media, I see how it is becoming more and more desperate, more and more urgent for us to pay close attention to the legacies of President Obama. Obama, as I have argued elsewhere and on this media, historians will say later on that Obama outwitted history and God in his way, or some will say destiny in his way, made this possible. But I think one of the legacies of President Obama could be most effective in taking Africa out of this continent of diseases, continent of poverty, continent of deprivation. When he invited the African leaders to Washington, much was expected from the African leaders. Much was also expected for America. Unfortunately, for some, it's a mismatch. For the more optimistic Africans, they still see light at the end of the tunnel. If you are that optimistic about light at the end of the tunnel before his term comes to an end, then we must see that light as the light of enlightenment, light of revelation. That takes us back to the Berlin Conference when Africa was divided up. Deja vu. Africans are now beginning to find themselves in a similar situation, similar circumstances. This time, Africa is not being carved out in Europe. Today, ironically, the African leaders themselves are caught in the power play of the international system. You have the United States, you have Western Europe, and now you have BRICS nations. And the Africans are caught in between these emerging powers. They have five things which Africans must pay close attention to. Number one, BRICS nations, except for South Africa, and now Egypt, I gather, is trying to join, which is another problem for us. The other thing is, the big nations have India, former British colony, now independent in our own ways, China, never a Western colony, was divided during World War II. You see, when the Japanese were rising, then you have Brazil, a neighbor in South America. BRICS nations are not necessarily nuclear threat to America, but they have that capacity. When you look at Russia as a leader in that group, China in that group. But the most important thing for us to think about the legacies of Obama is to see to what extent Obama will be able to develop superior diplomacy to get all these countries in the world to recognize the fact that, bottom line, we are all human beings. We all have the same DNA. America is still number one, whether people like this or not, because we have the technology. Most of these countries that are now running around with technology got the technology for America. But, of course, with all humility for all of us in the United States, we got the original technology from the English and all the Europeans, Germans, Italians, Spanish, Dutch, French, and all the European groups. They all added to the development. The Scandinavians, especially, who really empower many of our thinking human beings through the Nobel Prize awards over and over again. So when we look at Obama and his legacies, health should be now primary, because health for the Africans. Africa is the mother continent of the planet. All human beings, through DNA, came out of Africa, whether they like this or not. If Africa is now struck by AIDS, former President Bush did very well before he left town, and he left money to advances. President Clinton did the same thing. They were all people who were affected by AIDS. Today, we are pushing back AIDS, putting it back into the bottle. Now we have Ebola, and Obama is at the helm of affairs. So Ebola has to be put in that bottle. And that can only happen not only through American ingenuity and American know-how, but it should be done. The Center for Disease Control could be empowered by the Congress to have a world conference to look at Ebola. It's not an American thing, but America is a leader. America could do the diplomacy. We're not fighting Russians. We're not fighting Chinese. We're not fighting Brazilians. We're not fighting any of these countries. This is a human problem. But lo and behold, the African leaders have to get their act together. Sierra Leoneans, Liberians, Guineans, and all the other African countries who are likely to be affected by this disease as AIDS did several decades ago. This time around, under President Obama, we are in a high time, good time now, to engage the world diplomatically. Disease, stupid. And this way, Africa will not be totally marginalized and the prospect of African industrial development stymied. And that's the way it is today. For Obama to spend a great deal of time on diseases in Africa which affect the human race. And America has a role to play because we have people like Albert Schweitzer, who went to Gabon. There are countless people like him. They live in Stone. Many other people who came from Europe came as Good Samaritan, secular individuals. They all made what they could for people who have eyes to be healed. That's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of us here at Nightline Africa, we thank you for joining us tonight and hope to see you again tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In a further sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on seven top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, has control of large areas of southern and central Somalia and is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has engaged in a campaign of violence, including bombings and suicide attacks, which have killed thousands. In July 2010, it planned and executed a bomb attack in Kampala, Uganda, that killed more than 70 people, including an American citizen. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now, for the first time, the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of seven of its leaders. A reward of up to $7 million is being offered for information leading to the location of Al-Shabaab's founder, Ahmed Abdi Omohamed. 35 years old, he was born in Hargeisa, Somalia, and has used the aliases Mukhtar Abdulrahim Abu Zubair and Sheikh Mukhtar. He has exercised command responsibility for the group's operations and also served as a conduit for its financing. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Al-Mohamed's associates, Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Mohamed Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohamed Mahmoud, an Al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982. Mukhtar Robu, a 43-year-old who has served as an Al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional Al-Shabaab leaders, Al-Muhammad's deputy, Abdullahi Yare, and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Herzi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The U.S. guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.